We're kidding ourselves if we think people will stop talking.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 255 for the week of June 10th, 2019. I am Blissful Drip, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Gossip for Another Day, Sarah D. Bunting.
Like close friends.
Instantly regretful new teacher, Tara Ariano.
Ooh, why did I come here?
And fanny pack over puffer vest, Eve Beatty.
I'm going to buy every kid in the school a polar bear, and then I'm going to fire up the PlayStation. I'm going to fuck that polar bear, but I'll always be thinking about you.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. First, before we begin, some minor site business. Dave is here in body, very little in spirit, so we will be skipping him in all of our usual segments. Until we get to game time, he's going to be conserving his strength until that happens. So thank you all for your patience. And now to welcome our guest, Eve Beatty.
Hi, Eve.
Yay! Hey, guys. I was hoping Dave's illness would prevent that.
Somebody
but okay.
is biting our daughter.
Dave is not too sick to be able to use the soundboard. So we're here to talk about season two of Big Little Lies. And I personally felt when the first season ended, it was pretty perfect. I didn't really feel like we needed to proceed with the story. It seemed like that finale left it pretty obvious that the detective was going to continue to investigate this case, and where that went, we would not necessarily ever find out, and I was fine living in that mystery. And then they announced season two, directed by Andrea Arnold, co-starring Meryl Streep as Dead Perry's mother. And even though this whole thing really just feels like fan service for people who love actresses, now that it's happened, I kind of don't mind. Eve, what were your thoughts going into the premiere?
Well, like similar to you, I was like, you know, just let it go. Be like England, you know, do your season and then get out. But then I will tell you, and I thought of this when I was listening to this very podcast last week, when you mentioned the Deadwood movie, and you said you were so happy to see your friends. When I saw everybody meet up at the school in that first episode, I had such like a full body thrill at seeing everyone say hi to each other that I was sort of like, that's fine. I'll just watch these chicks hang out and look at what Laura Dern's wearing for a couple of episodes. That's completely okay. And then as soon as Meryl Streep got rolling, I was like, I'm actually interested. I'm interested in watching, you know, what Zoe Kravitz is going to do with what she's been given here. And I'm interested in seeing what happens with everything else too that are in episodes that the folks listening haven't watched yet.
Sarah, what about you?
Yeah, I was about the same. I was annoyed that they couldn't leave well enough alone, but also I live in the, you know, American world of TV. So once this was such a big prestige-y hoop de hoy last season, I knew it would be back. But it's like, okay, they have a shot at making it something interesting and not like true detectiving into the shitter. And so far, I am gratified. There's a moment in, you know, I was watching the first episode, and there's a moment, I mean, you know, everybody's talking about all the Meryl Streep stuff, and she is perfect, and we can get back to her. But there's a moment where Renata, Laura Dern, is like trying to storm out of the school and gets trapped in a hallway marching band that is everything that I love about this show and about the portrayal of her and like just that character and why I love her, that she's such a badass but also such a like suppurating wound sometimes at the same time, that just it just feels very true. And yeah, it is kind of nice to see our friends. Reese Witherspoon's Madeline is you know, a kindred spirit, I feel. So yeah, I was very cautiously optimistic, and now I am less cautious but still optimistic.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I love that you brought up the marching band moment, because it's true that what I had forgotten about the show in the interim since it last aired was how comparatively little the show is actually about the mystery in the first season, which is Shailene Woodley's character, Jane, has been raped. She doesn't know her assailant, and we don't find out until almost the very end who it is. And it turns out to be Celeste's husband, the Nicole Kidman character, and that's why part of why he ends up dead in the finale, which is what this season is going to be nominally, you know, in giant air quotes about. But yes, it's the smaller observations about life in this town that is what the show is really more about than any kind of crime aspects of it, despite this kind of window dressing and what the series title would have you believe.
Yeah.
I also like what they're giving to Adam Scott here. I mean, like that first season, he was sort of walk. I mean, as I recall, when I wrote about it for Previously TV, I sort of like pitched this theory that, hey, maybe he's the killer, or maybe he's the bad guy, because I thought, why would you just, you know, buy Adam Scott and have him just be this like get along guy so that he gets to show his weaselier, you know, sort of stepbrother side a little bit now. Yeah. I like it though. I'm so happy, you know, because we know he's got it in him. And so letting him sort of roll that out a little bit and not just be a cuckold is really nice and gratifying, even though, you know, I don't care about men.
Yeah, who does? So, yes, getting back to the story of this season, we already mentioned her, Meryl Streep, as Mary Louise, who's dead Perry's mother. And she has come to town supposedly to help Celeste with Perry's rotten twin sons. Dave, who dipped in and out. I think he obviously watched the episode that we watched for the canon, the first episode that we watched before we made this the lead topic in season one. But other than that, it's been kind of in and out and said, these are two bad news bears ass looking 70s kids. And it's true.
Yeah.
But really she's there. Mary Louise is there in town to try to figure out what actually happened before Perry was killed. Was it an accident or was it not? It's pretty clear she's already got some suspicions. And Sarah, you said we can circle back to her. So why don't we do that? What are your thoughts?
She is serving just perfect passive aggressive. I mean, talk about a snide fuck. Like this character, occasionally there's like a gleam of something that you would feel compassion for. But the fact is this woman raised Perry and it is horrible. Like it is so funny to watch her and Reese Witherspoon in scenes together like that. Their initial scenes together before the sort of hostilities are more out in the open. That she's like, she breaks off in the middle of bitching that Celeste should get a proper housekeeper to be like, you're very short. And Madeline is just like trying to process that someone else is as much of a bully as she is. Like, I love Madeline, but she's a social bully. And just watching her like, the wheels turning for Madeline with this person who is not going to be cowed by her is amazing. And it's Meryl Streep's performance is perfectly calibrated in terms of its hatefulness. She never goes too far. It's really great. And you know, when you're sort of tempted to feel for this woman, as you know, a parent who did lose a child and who does want to know what happened, but then we know what he was and that what happened should have happened. It's just really interesting to watch, and I'm interested to see what they're going to do with that and with her as the season goes on.
Eve, what about you?
Well, is she wearing teeth, like different teeth or something?
I think she is.
Like she's okay, yeah, because there's like something with her mouth, and so sometimes it doesn't quite work for me. Like I hear a little bit of a like, you know, vampire show thing. But you know, but still, like you know, it, just like with Celeste's kids, as a person who owns a store in San Francisco, I've met that Meryl Streep character a million times. They come and they go, oh, how's it going? I know retail, the small business, it's so hard now with the Amazon. oh, and how old are you? You know, and the same with those kids. Those kids would be tearing a bunch of shit up while the parents are completely oblivious. These people are completely real people. And that maybe just says more about how terrible the Bay Area is than how good the show is.
Well, they've infested Brooklyn as well. So, yeah.
I'm sorry, Sarah.
Yeah, I love how, you know, our central women, other than Jane, I guess, are sort of get their way through their status. And Mary Louise, you know, has no status in town. No one knows who she is, really. So the way she's going to get over with people is by claiming like one of the few privileges that older women have, which is to not give a fuck. Like when she has that moment where she, you know, tells Reese Witherspoon she's short and then says she's always thought short people weren't trustworthy. And then when Madeline like takes a few hours to let that sink in and then runs into her again in the premiere, she calls her on it. And then like Mary Louise backs down, but does she? Not really. Like the way, yeah, these people are very, very realistic. I mean, there, and it's not just the Bay Area, of course, like there are judgmental people everywhere, but yeah, the creation of the character of Mary Louise as both, you know, a person who's lost a child, as Sarah said, but also someone who lost that child and also like is now canonizing him after his death. Like at dinner with the kids is talking about how she was out with other friends of hers and they were talking about their kids and they weren't a patch on your father. He was great, blah, 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 blah. Like, oh God, like this can't go anywhere good.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we saw in the last season that Perry was like fun dad.
Yeah.
And was always playing them, or like was always playing Celeste against them. And so it's no surprise that they're totally unsocialized little terrors, because that's what they had modeled. So She does seem to be able to control them, though. I'll give her that.
Yes, she does.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Jane has a job now. She's working at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. She has a new coworker who's played by Ben from Big Love. His name, I think, is Douglas Smith. He does not look like he has aged at all since then. He still looks like a teenager to me. But he seems like he kind of has her number. And so that'll be interesting to watch, I think.
For sure.
Well, and, you know, we're talking about all of this, like, very seriously, but I think, you know, I felt like every single line Laura Dern had was just, like, spun so perfectly and was so funny. I watched all three of these episodes while I was on a plane, and I was laughing aloud. The kid who was seated in the aisle seat moved. because, I mean, Laura Dern is doing an amazing job, but also every single line she has is so funny. Even when she's in sort of a dire circumstance, she's so hilarious. Mm-hmm.
And I love that Gordon, her husband, has become a serious model train guy. Seeing him in his model train lair, like that's like, real perfect. Dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have some. In a later episode, they have a fight in the car, and
that was great.
Yeah, and then like people are honking, and when she finally drives off, her like kiss off line, like she's perfect, and it's like it's the Laura Derniest somehow that she's this. Like she looks great and she's this like amazing sort of work battle axe, but then is like barely holding the shreds of any given situation together at any given moment. And yeah, it's great. It is great. I've always loved her, but this is like she's clearly having a ball. Like they all are, and they're all pretty, like there are certain scenes where you can tell, even if it's like sort of a downbeat scene, that they're happy to be together, like getting to do this again. So that's fun.
Yeah. I love the detail that when she's introducing herself to Amabella's new teacher, that she brings up the bullying, even though we've just seen her like obviously go through this huge situation with Celeste, whose child was the bully in question. Like the fact that she hasn't let that go just because she and Celeste are closer as friends sort of hints that like, oh, that's still going to probably explode again at some point in the future. Like she has not forgotten. This is still a point of contention for her.
Also, the headmaster of this school is like, has negative fucks to give at this point and has like a secret smoking spot and is totally calling them out, like during assemblies that the parents called. It is good. I am enjoying it so far. It doesn't need to exist, and I would have been okay with it not existing, but I'm glad it does, and it's like a fun ride so far. I'm into it.
Now that it's here, it's like, you know, you never say a child was unwanted that has been born. You say it was a surprise. That's what I feel like. This is an extremely tiny triumph. Last week, we were talking about how we've made up Gentleman Jack-related jingles to the Kit Kat theme. And this week, I noticed that it's not the only HBO title that fits into that model. And I typed out a tweet and indicated that it was to be sung to the Kit Kat jingle. And here's how it goes. Big Little Lies, Gentleman Jack, Insecure, Euphoria, Girls Divorce. Completely idiotic. And at HBO, RT'd it. Thank you very much.
Yay!
Well done.
So I mentioned for the past couple of weeks in my plugs that the ATX Television Festival was coming up, and now we are on the other side of it. It has just concluded. So I thought, Sarah, since she came down for it, and I could talk a little bit about our experience of it. So this is, I think, my fourth time going. Sarah, this was your first. What are your overall impressions of the fest?
It was great. It definitely is for, you know, serious TV fans. I particularly enjoyed slash was touched by going to the Veronica Mars panel on Saturday morning and having Rob Thomas talk about Television Without Pity. Like
twice.
This, yeah, like this thing that we made that I, you know, really can't take that much credit for. Like I grabbed Tara and Dave's coattails, it flapped past, and then we picked out some good people and the rest, as they say, et cetera. But it's really quite touching that people remember it fondly. So thank you, Veronica Marsians, Marshmallows. It was a good mix of like, not fluffy, but like more fun topics and heavy topics. The fact, fiction, and criminal justice panel sort of went in a direction that maybe no one expected, but it was still interesting. They had a lot of like screenings and exclusive stuff. I think they do a great job staying right on that line between it kind of like turning into Sundance and being like a capital S scene. Like that they still get really good content and top creators and stuff, but like they remember who the conversation is supposed to be with and for. Mm-hmm. I think they do a really good job with that. So yeah, it was really fun, and I learned a lot, and I'm definitely going to come back.
I just want to say about the fact, fiction, and criminal justice panel that Sarah mentioned, it was co-sponsored, I guess, with the ACLU. The moderator was from there. And so the panelists were two producers on The Red Line, which they had just found out like that day that CBS was not going to pick it up again. So Speaking of no fucks given, Caitlin Parrish was like, well, here's what we wanted to do and here's what we had to do because it was on CBS and we had to like treat it as a Trojan horse, which was that was great. But also on the panel was the executive producer of Good Trouble, whose name is Joanna Johnson. She is a white lady, I would say, probably in her 40s or early 50s. And so they were talking about being aware of unconscious biases and being in the writer's room and talking about Rachel, the Bachelorette, two Bachelorettes ago, the black Bachelorette, famously. And Joanna commenting that, like, well, she seems, you know, she's so educated, she's so well-spoken, and one of the black writers in the room being like, and so Joanna going to find her after and being like, let's talk about what just happened, I don't understand. And she said, well, that word is triggering when you're talking about an African-American person. And Joanna Johnson says, Sarah.
She's like, I was really talking about her being a bachelorette.
The room laughed for like, I'm gonna say, no kidding, a full minute. Like it was so good.
So good.
Yeah.
So good.
So some of the other panels that we went to, on the power of female partnerships was the only one I saw on the first day. All I'll say about that one is that if you have an opportunity to go see Retta on a panel, you should do it because she was hilarious. We saw a panel about the making of competition series with the showrunner of The Challenge and the showrunner of Making It, which was fascinating, I thought, especially for you as a person who watches both.
Yeah. And they were like super fans of each other's. So that was cool. And then an executive producer on Dancing with the Stars like Skyped in and then Skyped back out, which was fine because like I'm sympathetic to his travails, but also don't care about that show. So,
yeah. Also, like, there's not much to say about designing challenges on Dancing with the Stars. It's like they dance, like that's it. There's, you know, there's fanfare and stuff around it, but yeah, that was felt like it was kind of shoot.
Yeah, this time a backflip, like no, right. Cool.
I'll just close up by mentioning two of the screenings that I went to for shows that have not premiered yet. Alternatino, I went with our guest next week, Omar Gayaga. This is the new sketch show that's coming to Comedy Central next Tuesday, starring Arturo Castro, who is probably best known as Jaime from Broad City. Really, really funny. Very smart. He's from Guatemala, and they one of the bits that they do in the first episode is a tourism ad for Guatemala, where it's basically like "fuck you, Costa Rica, we're the same, but no one wants to come to us." And then saying like later in the season, Costa Rica gets to respond, which is even funnier.
That's hilarious.
So that premiere is actually already on YouTube, and we will link that in the show notes as well. And then on the last day, the last panel that I went to was for a show called Sherman's Showcase. And this was created by Diallo Riddle and Bashar Salahuddin, who are formerly both writers on Jimmy Fallon. They are also sometime actors. Bashar Salahuddin is Keith on Glow, so you've definitely seen him. He is great. But the premise of this show is that it's like a retrospective of a Soul Train type of show that started in 1972 and is still on. And so it's like a quasi-documentary, quasi-spoof kind of thing where they're, you know, cutting, it's non-linear, they're cutting through various time periods. You have people playing, like, obviously a version of James Brown that is not James Brown or a version of Prince. But yeah, it's really very pointed, super funny. It's coming on IFC July 31st, I believe. So yeah, we will probably talk about that again closer to the time. I hope we get screeners because it's super duper funny. So yeah, ATX, it's a good time.
It is.
It's time to go around the dial. First stop, Tara Ariano.
As you are listening to this, Pose has just premiered its second season on FX. There's a bit of a time jump. It's now 1990, and New York is in the thick of the AIDS crisis. And so this has made the show a lot more pointed and a lot more political, and I am here for it. It's really good. We basically get to see Pray Tell get radicalized by the nurse who is treating him for HIV, who is played by Sandra Bernhard. She takes him to an ACT UP meeting, and like in real time, he gets on board with like protesting and stuff. Whereas before, he'd been kind of nervous about it and unsure and stuff. But in the premiere, we get to see the whole House of Evangelista go and stage a die-in at St. Patrick's Cathedral, and it's amazing. It's just bracing and shocking and really upsetting, and they cut between, you know, the regular footage and then what it's made to look like as news footage, and it's, you know, upsetting. It also starts at the episode begins at Potter's Field, where all of the corpses of unclaimed AIDS victims have been like quarantined from the other corpses because, as the woman who works there says, we don't know how this spreads. Like, it's 1990. Yes, you do. But I think this is a great direction for the show to go in. I mean, the ball stuff is still amazing, even more so, actually. But yeah, I love the show. I'm so glad it's back. And I love the new edge that the season has. So check it out. FX Tuesday nights. For my plug, this is off our ATX Festival notes. The ATX Festival has a podcast that is called TV Campfire. We have had the hosts of it on before, Emily Gibson and Caitlin McFarland, who co-founded the festival. So if you are not able to make it to the festival this year, you can very soon download and listen to audio of all of the panels every single one from the festival, including the two that I moderated. Hello. So ATX TV Campfire, we will link to it in the show notes. But if you are a lover of TV, you will probably love that.
Eve Beatty.
Well, I thought about talking about Black Mirror, but I'm just going to kite off Sarah. And I also thought about talking about The Chef Show because I'm enjoying it very much, but it's too hot in San Francisco to think about cooking. So I want to talk about something that's a little bit stale, but I keep thinking about, and that's RuPaul's Drag Race. Look, season 11 was not as bad as season 7. That's the Violet Chachki one. But still, I think we can all agree that this show is starting to sag a bit. As a person who lives in the world, I understand that reality shows have that sort of breakfast club thing going. You have to get like the jock and the weird person and the pageant girl and the comedy queen. But it's the weird person, the person who bitches and moans about how no one understands her oh-so-transgressive drag, that is most problematic for me and for many of my friends, especially my friends who live here in San Francisco. To us, and maybe to you guys too, because everyone here is pretty cosmopolitan. The weird girl storyline is the stuff of like a small town high school, you know, where you're like, oh, I'm so unusual because I wear Chuck Taylors and no one gets it. You know, it's Pretty in Pink was a long time ago, and there isn't just one weird person in your high school anymore. Instead, the weird queen seems more like a Daffod Thomas. That's the Little Britain guy who's always like, I'm gay. And everyone else is like, yeah, we know. We don't care. Everybody's gay. It's no big deal. And that's what I want to say to people like Evie Oddly, who I'm sure is a nice person. And I really do wish her the very best. But cutting edge, she is not. And I resent the show's efforts to convince me otherwise. I understand there was a time when Drag Race needed to make itself accessible to the mainstream, but look, even Rue admitted back in that 2016 interview with Vulture that all of that drag stuff has been appropriated and mainstream to the point that his disgust was almost palpable. So I'm really stumped about why the show is sticking to casting quote-unquote weird queens whose weirdness is limited to Halloween costumes hot glued to pumps. My fondest hope for season 12 is that Rue will throw open drag stores to trans and non-binary performers, not just folks who admit their gender identity once they're in the door. And here's an idea. How about some folks from San Francisco? There have long been rumors, even some covered in our paper record, the San Francisco Chronicle, swirling about Rue's beef with SF. Did you know that out of the 11 seasons of this show, only one queen has been from SF?
What?
Forgive the expression.
That's crazy.
Girl, this is
how
true.
Is that even possible?
It's not just crazy, guys. It's fishy.
Yeah.
So here's a side note. That one queen.
I see what you did there.
Honey Mahogany. Thank you. Honey Mahogany is the one San Francisco queen the show's ever had. And here's the thing. You don't see her on the circuit these days. That's not because she was treated shamefully on Drag Race, even though she was. Instead, she is rising in San Francisco political ranks. She's now aide to the city's arguably most powerful supervisor. Mark my words, Honey Mahogany is going to be San Francisco's mayor one day. So, you know, it all worked out okay. But anyway, I don't know what the deal is with Drag Race right now and how it just feels like it's running on fumes. But whatever it is, Drag Race needs to, as Rue would say in his impression of Cher, snap out of it. By keeping everyone but cis males out of the show, Drag Race is strangling itself. When it's good, it's just so good, and I'd hate to see it wither away. Anyway, so for my plug, unless anyone wants to disagree with me right now, you can.
I can't argue with anything you said. I like this season fine, but you make some excellent points, and the San Francisco stat is insane.
Now that I know that, I can't unknow it, and I'm going to be a, like, Drag Race Frisco truther. And that's really hard to do.
Mm-hmm. It is, right? I'm not saying that we have the best drag or like the most amazing drag. I mean, I definitely think that, you know, we have broken a lot of barriers in terms of transgressive drag, and our weird girls, like Evie Oddly here, would basically be a pageant girl. So yeah, I don't know, guys. But anyway, thank you for allowing me to say my piece. For my plug, I would like to talk about Best Evidence. It's a direct to your inbox editorial product that I do with my friend Sarah Bunting.
Oh.
It's about all the true crime. Oh, it's about all the true crime that's worth your time. Tara subscribes to it. Thank you, Tara.
Yes, thank
so
you
know it's got to be good. It's 5 days a week. It's $5 a month to get everything. Otherwise, you can subscribe for free and get 2 issues a week. And that's $55 a year if you want a deal. And Sarah and I write it. It goes to your email. What else could you ask for? Anyway, thank you for your time.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Black Mirror, can we even call this a season? I guess we can. It's three episodes. They were all fairly long. This was a unique season, and not in a good way, in that I watched them and I enjoyed them, and I didn't really like, they didn't stick with me. I didn't really feel any kind of way. It just felt a little bit like, you know, they felt like they, it was time for another season. So they made these, and, you know, they all just felt a little flat, a little too long in a way that these episodes almost never do to me. Maybe it's run its course. I mean, again, they're not bad, but the ideas on offer seemed vaguer and broader, and the episodes seemed more reliant on the casting, which worked across the board, don't get me wrong. But this season felt more like a sour meditation on an undesirable present than a sharp imagining of unintended consequences in a near future. This sounds negative, and I don't actually feel negative about the new episodes. I just don't feel that much about them, or as much as I have in the past. There's just something that's not quite there that was there before, and I can't quite put my finger on what it is. Eve, it sounds like you also watched it.
Well, first, sir, I can't believe that you don't remember that Carl fucked the polar bear, because I thought that was amazing. My husband and I talk about fucking the polar bear all the time now, and anytime he yells at a driver or anything, I say, maybe you should go play a video game with him. So, you know, that's going to be a fixture in our marriage. Now, I thought the second episode was some fucking stinky bullshit, though. What the fuck was that? Moriarty and the guy in the car and Topher Grace and everything. I get it. You know, Jack from Twitter likes to meditate. That was just stupid. Don't fuck around on your phone when you drive. This has nothing to do with Twitter. People were fucking around and doing other things in their phone while they were driving long before social media was addictive. I don't know. I just felt like you said, Sarah, that everything was sort of wedged into the technology theme, and that's fine. But then just have an anthology show where weird shit happens.
Well, yeah. And it just felt, that one especially, like I enjoyed Topher Grace's performance, but it was like, it was such like low-hanging fruit, really. This whole, like, the whole character was almost like all reliant on production design. I am glad that he sort of gave himself up to it. It is a little weird to see Topher Grace with like crow's feet, I have to say. But it seemed, in the past, Black Mirror has seemed like not prescriptive but or predictive, but just more like forward, and here it felt reactive. And yes, hot priest with a hostage, like, and he that he crashes in a field next to a transformer. I'm not sure I get it, Eve.
Well, I mean, and even like the first one, like we can talk about how obviously when he said, oh, did you feel anything after we kissed? Anthony Mackie did. And Anthony Mackie is actually just gay. And that's why he doesn't talk to his friend. But then, you know, let's just have a show about where it's weird when maybe you want to fuck your friend and you're married to a lady. I mean, it just, the technology stuff was so tangential that I felt like, you know, people kept saying, well, bump the tech up when it was immaterial. And I also felt bad for Antenna Girl that she had to have that guy's fingers in her mouth. I was uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. It was nice to see Nikki Beharie again. I always enjoy her performances, but what a thankless role this was. This one was also a little too long. I will say about the last one, Miley Cyrus is having the time of her fucking life. Good for her. It was sort of a weird, I wanted that one to be a little longer, actually. And it, like, it had some good payoffs in it, but it was also, again, like, is this about technology?
No, it's about being a child star. And I thought you have such an opportunity when you have Miley Cyrus to really go big on that. And instead they didn't. But, you know, that said, I would download and listen to that head like a whole cover, as well as the weird other versions she did during the show. I liked them both.
Yeah, she said, I mean, she's having a great time. Yeah. So for my plug, Speaking of true crime that's worth your time, The Blotter Presents is celebrating its 100th full-length episode this week. Unfortunately, my guest and I, the great Toby Ball, were not all that celebratory of our topics, but give it a listen. Maybe you have watched these documentaries. You can tell us what you thought, but yay, Blotter 100. On to the next 100. Here we go.
Today's extra credit topic comes from Dan Cassino, and it's called Your Own Personal A-Team. And Dan writes, your significant other or dog or mother or DVR has been kidnapped, and you need to assemble a team of TV characters to get them back. Like the original A-Team, it should consist of someone tough, someone smart, someone charming, and someone who's a little crazy. Who's your team, and what TV character is the nefarious kidnapper behind the crime? I'll go first. My tough, Rosa from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Oh, damn it.
She's super strong, but also incredibly lithe and agile, and I think that would be useful in a pinch. Smart, Desna Sims from Claws, which also just came back this week. Smart, but also crafty, which is important in a situation like this. Charming, Trixie from Call the Midwife. She could charm anyone into anything, including if it's something evil. We've never actually seen her do that on Call the Midwife, but I believe she has that capacity. A little crazy. This was kind of obvious, but Villanelle from Killing Eve. She has strange methods, but I think we can all agree after season two, she gets the job done. And my kidnappers are Val and Kurt from Big Mouth. These are Jay's older brothers. And their crime is they kidnap our dog, Murray, to be a friend slash partner in mayhem to the Bilzerian pit bull feature, whose name is featuring Ludacris. Eve.
So one of TV's greatest villains is holding, get this, United States of America hostage. That's right. It's the host of reality competition show, Donald Trump, host of The Apprentice, and the stakes could not be higher. Tragically, as in the film's executive decision, the group of expert men entrusted with saving the country blew it. So now it's up to our team. So for someone tough, I have Zoe from Serenity. That's the Gina Torres character. I'm not a huge Serenity fan, but you know, if there's anybody that I want on my side in a battle, it's certainly Zoe. For someone smart, I would like Annalise Keating of How to Get Away with Murder. She doesn't always make the best decisions, but she comes through in a pinch, and I think she also kind of covers crazy a little bit. So for someone charming, I would like Maeve Millay of Westworld. I mean, there isn't anyone that's more charming and or deadly. And for someone who's a little crazy, I would like Cookie Lion from Empire.
Nice.
I believe that if that group can't do it and save us, no one can.
I agree. Sarah.
Okay. So whoever kidnapped Pearl, my cat, is going to pay because they took Pearl and now they're stuck with her because she's an asshole. But we would like her back because she's our asshole. So I am borrowing Rosa from Tara's team from Brooklyn Nine-Nine as my tough guy for charming and deceptively mellow and able to hide small white cats in his beard, the guy from High Maintenance. I don't know what made me think of this show or this character, especially since the show kind of ruined the character and I haven't watched it in years, but remember Blindspot? No, I know, but their tech lady is named Patterson. And I always liked her. And she like managed to have good eyeliner while cracking codes. My kind of girl. So she's our smart teammate and a little bit crazy. Pam from Archer is Howlin' Mad Poovy. with all of that said, I don't know who is both dastardly and self-hating enough to engage in a Pearl napping. So I'm just going to go with a character who is somewhat similar to Pearl in personality, i.e. appealing, but also extremely sulky. And that's Darlene Connor. Sorry, girl. And when we foil your evil plot, your punishment is kidnapping the other two cats. Good luck!
It is time for the Canon user submission this week. Let's hit it.
Hi, Extra Hot Great Friends. This is Francoise, and today I'd like to nominate Parts Unknown, Season 7, Episode 6, Senegal, for entry into the canon. As of this recording, no episode of Parts Unknown has been presented for the canon, so first let me briefly make the case for why this series is canon-worthy. Simply put, there is no travel show as beautiful, as empathetic, and as humanist as Parts Unknown. Already in its earlier iteration, the Travel Channel's No Reservations, it was clear that Tony Bourdain was not interested in making a typical travel or food show. Yes, he traveled, and yes, he ate, but he was always more interested in who he was eating with than in the logistics of what tourist sites to see or what restaurants not to miss. When his show moved to CNN, it freed him further to take huge risks. He traveled to more dangerous places like Libya or hard-to-reach places like Bhutan. He also took more visual risks, pushing his crew to emulate different directors and visual styles, all in service of capturing the soul of a place and its people, not just a travel brochure from the Department of Tourism. Mostly, Tony had a one-of-a-kind voice that makes the show so distinct and so missed. He was a sarcastic curmudgeon with an enormous heart and a capacity to connect with people he met. He brought us to places that most of us will never have a chance to visit, and he humanized the people, the history, the culture of those places. He taught us not to fear the world, but to embrace it with an open heart. So hopefully we can agree that Parts Unknown is canon-worthy, but why do I think this episode is such a great example of the show at its best? Because the things that Tony loves most are all present in this episode. There are chefs, street food, history, especially post-colonial history, democracy, dive bars, music, musicians, car racing, eating food on the beach, and a shared home-cooked meal in a person's home. He's in the kind of setting where he and his team often do their best work, a place that many Americans have never been and honestly probably can't find on a map, with a fascinating history that is unfamiliar to too many people. He's gently educating us, but he isn't lecturing. He's curious, and it allows us to be curious, too. He's doing a good amount of stereotype deconstructing by letting people, Muslims and Black women in particular, speak for themselves. Here is a place where some women wear a hijab and some don't, and they are given the space to talk about their lives and their choices for themselves. There are many loving shots of food that look delicious. Fresh seafood on the beach, greasy lamb on brown paper, a spicy lentil sandwich on fresh baguette. And there are equally loving shots of musicians performing. Tony loves music and musicians. He sees them as uniquely insightful and symbolic about the culture of a place. He has great conversations with local musicians about what makes Senegal unique and hopeful for the future. Plus, we get to hear some incredible Senegalese music. Also, he obviously cannot resist the chance to drive cars very fast on dangerous terrains, a habit that has nearly gotten him killed in past episodes, and I don't think a truly great Parts Unknown would be complete without Tony indulging at least one of his dangerous vices. Everything in this episode is so beautifully shot. The B-roll of the Senegalese going about their daily lives praying, cooking, shopping, surfing, working, driving, and hustling. Although the visual style of some episodes are very purposefully different in homage to different directors of a particular country or culture, I think this is a great example of their most common visual style. We see the beauty of the setting, but mostly of the people. Those individual moments where a person locks eyes with the camera and therefore us, the viewers. The episode ends, as it so often does, with a home-cooked meal by an auntie. Think about this in the context of what is supposedly a travel show. This is an experience that you or I or any tourist could not replicate. It's not a restaurant or a tourist attraction, it's a person's home. And yet Tony knows this is the way into the true heart of a people, and that's what he is interested in. Get to know the Senegalese, see them as the beautiful, interesting, and loving, culturally rich human beings that they are, and you will be a traveler, not a tourist. I haven't cut many clips because I find so much of the conversations interesting and educational, and so many of the voiceovers a classic of the Tony Bourdain voice, that I would end up clipping everything and this show would go on forever. But I will leave you with the Senegalese chef Pierre Thiam's words about Taringa.
You know, I think food is such a great way of uniting people, you know. It's like breaking barriers. Food is not only about feeding yourself here in Senegal is a whole culture. The most important value is what we call teranga. The more you share, the more your bowl will be plentiful. It's not how much you have, it's how much you give. That's what matters in Senegal. So teranga is that culture.
This is a concept that is central to Senegalese culture, but if there were ever a mission statement for Parts Unknown, that would be it. Tony taught us that food, music, and history are the ways into a larger understanding about the world, and this Senegal episode does those three things so beautifully and with so much love. I hope you agree and choose to vote this episode into the canon. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Françoise, for your submission. Eve, you picked this out of our list of submissions. Why don't you go first?
Well, I mean, first, that was a remarkable presentation.
It really was. That was lovely.
That was really good. Yeah. Yeah, it was really beautiful. I picked it because I thought it would be interesting to see if I would be able to evaluate this show, you know, a year after Tony Bourdain's death and, you know, look at it coldly. No, I can't. I mean, it's impossible, at least for me, to watch the show and not, you know, and not think about his ending. And, you know, and that's hard, right? I mean, like, I didn't know the guy, you know, I don't have some story about me and Tony Bourdain and we passed each other once and I'm going to put it on my blog. But, you know, it's hard not to watch it and feel such a sense of loss because he was in, you know, what he and his crew created was so unique and incomparable. I was struck, you know, by something that Françoise said, you know, and also something that I saw, how he listened to women and let them speak in a way that I, you know, so few men in life or on television do. So I guess I was just really, I wanted a chance to watch a show and feel like I had to for work. And, you know, I'm glad that I got to with this.
Sarah.
My notes actually echoed Françoise's lovely presentation several times. That the first note I took was that I was surprised at how effortlessly it was teaching me without lecturing me. The shot making really is stunning. I don't necessarily notice this stuff as much as some people, but there's one shot of a little boy on a boat or a ferry just sort of looking speculatively into the distance, and it's just really lovely. Like, it's framed perfectly and you just wonder what that kid is thinking. But there's also a shot about two-thirds of the way through of Bourdain looking out the window of his cab, and there's just a rue to it, which, you know, maybe I'm projecting that because of what came after, but it really was quite something if you think about the fact that perhaps the camera operator was documenting something without even knowing it. This was really delightful. I watched it while I was eating lunch, and I was eating the whitest thing on. I was literally eating a cucumber sandwich. Like, what food is whiter than this? It did not have mayonnaise on it. That was the only way it could have been whiter. And then there,
Sarah, I was eating a breakfast burrito. So yeah, I see you.
They're just like these beautiful close-ups of this stew and this fish, and they're sitting on the beach, and there are just as many shots of Bourdain looking utterly content and gratified that this is his life and his job. And as my final note, I will say that he breezes by. He's talking about some, like, the history of sort of recent political protest in Senegal. And in the context of talking to one of the interviewees who is a hip hop artist in Senegal. And his voiceover is like, this is an issue that poets like Chuck D have been, you know, bringing up for centuries. And I just, the way that he just like walked that line, you know, right up to us, like, yes, that's right. Poets like Chuck D, that I was like, that is Bourdain in a nutshell. I'm not disagreeing with his assessment, by the way. I think never watched this show before, like on purpose. I'm sure it was on in waiting rooms that I was in. But I think I'm going to come back to it. And truly, like, every now and then we get a canon presentation that's like, that's how you do it. And folks, that's how you do it. Like, we should have a sort of side hallway that's like the canon of canon presentations, because this would be in there for sure. Tara, bring us home.
Yeah, I loved how Francoise's presentation felt like it was in the style of the show.
Yeah, you know? Yes, it really did. It really did.
Yeah, the show in miniature. Yeah, it was a pleasure to watch and a pleasure to listen to. I'd never seen this show before at all, including in a waiting room. And empathetic and humanist are excellent descriptors. That's what I was sort of expecting going into it, and definitely what it delivers. And I'm not usually... I don't really watch travel shows, and I definitely don't watch food shows at all. And this doesn't feel like either one of those genres. It definitely does teach without lecturing, all the things that you guys have already said. But I mean, if you're going to do a show like this, this is what you have to do, with a definite, explicit consciousness of the history of the place where you are. And he doesn't shy away from talking about how colonial forces have shaped this country for good and ill sometimes. Although it was weird when they were talking about, like, you know, when a slave master had children with his slave, like, oh, yikes. Yikes, yikes, yikes. I mean, you kind of blow by that, I gather, you know, that's not something you can challenge when you're having a meal in someone's home. Like, I get it. But, you know, if the principle of the show is like you get to know a culture by sharing a meal with someone from that culture, like that's what the show feels like. And it's, you know, it doesn't sanitize the place. It doesn't try and buff it up. It feels like it's showing you the truth. And so it was great to watch. I have no way of saying whether it's typical or not, but it was definitely well done and a good way to spend 40 minutes. So let us vote, I guess. Eve.
Well, I have watched other episodes. I do think it is typical, and I vote yes.
Sarah.
I wanted to watch more episodes, and you know, Buncey criteria. So it's a yes for me as well. Thanks, Francoise.
And I will vote yes as well.
All right. That means Parts Unknown, Season 7, Episode 6, Senegal, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hawk Ray Camp.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Who has our winner?
Me. Our winner is Kristen Bell, who will make her directorial debut in season 4 of The Good Place, and just in the nick of time, since it was just also announced this week that season 4 will be the last for the show. I believe I have complained on this podcast before about how The Good Place felt, especially in season 3, like it was losing the thread, so I won't say this is just in the nick of time for the show, because I kind of feel like 2 seasons might have been enough for me, but 4 gives them a chance to show me what I wasn't seeing in season 3 in terms of how they intend to wrap it up with intention. So good luck convincing me. I don't know. Sarah.
Eve can share this loser with me because there's plenty of her bullshit to go around. That's Linda Fairstein, former ADA in New York City and prosecutor of the Central Park 5, who has been dropped by her publisher in part due to her portrayal in When They See Us. Her response is to tweet through it with a Wall Street Journal op-ed in which she's like, lies, damn lies, and no statistics. So yeah, she's also had to resign from like 50 boards.
Well, and the letter that she sent to the all the boards that she was on was basically like, yeah, I know. It's just like, you know, the mob mentality of Twitter and everything else. Like, she thinks she's going to ride through it. But I think, you know, the important thing to remember is, at least according to the producers on When They See Us, she was offered the opportunity to participate in the show and to speak with them. And she said if the producers were going to speak to the men, the Central Park 5, the central tenet of the show, she would not be participating. That is not a smart way to try to control the narrative. Even if you're like the evilest person, right? Which I'm not saying she is. If you're evil and you're smart, you're going to participate the fuck out of things and try to drive things your way by declining to comment. You let them write the story. So not only does this lady seem kind of mean, she seems dumb.
Speaking of mean and dumb. Do we know what time it is?
It's game time.
Yeah.
All right, this is the eighth game time of the season. The season scores are Tara 4, Value Guest 2, Sarah 1. Now, since we moved and our Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone Trivial Pursuit question boxes are still yet to be unearthed, I developed kind of a hankering for some straight-up trivia. So today we're going to do just that in something I am calling ABCTV Trivia.
Okay.
This comes with the help of the @EHG Assist team. I will cycle through the alphabet twice. I will read you a question, and you give me the answer that will start with the letter we are currently on. So player one will have an A answer. Player two will have a B answer, and we move through the alphabet like that. First name of the character and the first name of actor names defines what letter it belongs to in an answer. So okay. Seth Bullock would be an S answer.
Got it.
All right. Steel meal situation, please, Tara.
Thank you, Dave. Here is our steel meal situation. Sarah has 2. I have 6. Value guests have 3. And Eve, you know how steel meals work, of course, having been on this podcast many times. If you have a meal to steal, be aggressive and yell it out before Dave can give the correct answer.
Let's throw it to Pinky to see who will go first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right, so Eve is going first, and then we'll follow Eve with Tara, then Sarah. Are we ready to play ABCTV Trivia?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
You bet.
All right, here we go, starting with A for Eve. Try to remember what letter we're on. You'd think his theoretical loving adoptive family would call him Gordon or Mr. Shumway rather than this acronym.
ALF.
Correct. Tara.
Yes.
This show, now in its 9th season on CBS, centers on the family of New York's police commissioner.
Blue Bloods.
Correct. Sarah D. Bunting, your first question. If people used common sense and were capable of performing quick Google searches on their own, this show wouldn't need to exist.
Oh, Catfish.
All right. This is the first question created for this quiz by myself. So here we go. While sick, I hope this works out. I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night and I work all day. I cut down trees. I eat my lunch. I go to the lavatory. On Sundays, I go shopping and butcher people like me.
Dexter?
Correct. Tara Ariano, E.
Yes.
This 2017 Netflix series set in the UK officially uses 3 asterisks in its title.
The end of the fucking world.
Correct. Sarah D. Bunting. In the Star Trek Next Generation pilot, we encounter this starbase gifted to the Federation by the Bandy, but discovered to be an enslaved spaceborne entity. And you're on F.
The Forg? I don't know. I do not know. Sorry.
That's from the episode Encounter at Farpoint. That's Farpoint Starbase.
Okay.
To Eve. James Franco and Anne Hathaway have more in common than their disastrous Oscar hosting gig. Both starred in one season dramedies that debuted in 99. Franco was on NBC's Freaks and Geeks. What Fox series co-starred Hathaway?
God, I thought it was going to be Geeks. So I was like, fuck. Geeks and Freaks?
Incorrect. The show we were looking for, Get Real. Get Real.
Oh, that thing.
Huh? Tara, H. Mm-hmm. The only Buffy episode to receive an Emmy nomination for writing.
Hush.
All right. For Sarah D. Bunting, our first audio clue of the game. First Len and then Zach.
I'm triggered by that beautiful Casio. That is In Search Of ...
It is. And now let's listen to the end of that as it goes into the show.
Earthquakes are nature's most frightening events. For when the earth is at war with itself, there is no place to hide.
Come on, Bogue.
Eve, he has appeared on 20 seasons of MTV reality competition shows and won 6 of them. But don't confuse him with that character from Entourage. He hates that.
Johnny, is he Johnny Drama?
Steel Meal.
Yeah.
Johnny Bananas.
Johnny Bananas. Yes, correct. All right, Ariana. Kay. Child labor laws and adult supervision be damned. CBS was committed to the reality show craze with this TV show.
They sure were. Kid Nation.
Correct.
Oh, boy.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yep.
This HBO series sent a couple of his actors to the glue factory.
Oh, harsh.
Yeah, I wrote Luck? That. You can blame me. Luck.
well done.
For Eve, the letter M. Carl is worried that this drinking establishment might get rid of the dank.
Moe's.
Correct. Tara Ariano. N. This lead character lived in a town of little boxes made of ticky-tacky.
Nancy Botwin.
From Weeds, correct. All right, our final question before our first score break for Sarah. The letter is O. Paul Johansson went from playing creepy John Sears on Beverly Hills 90210 to playing creepy Dan Scott on this show.
One Tree Hill.
You are correct. And that's question 15. What are our scores, please?
Thank you, Dave. Very, very close game. Eve has 3 points. Sarah and I are tied with 5 each.
Dun, dun, all right. Dun.
Let's get back into it. Returning to Eve, the letter is the letter P. Here we go. Ginny Baker played for this Major League Baseball team in the short-lived Fox series Pitch.
Pass.
The Padres. This is question 17.
Spread Eagle.
It is Q for Tara. This cartoon sibling knows being popular is a full-time job, and the fashion club is her main extracurricular activity.
Gwen Morgendorfer.
Correct. Sarah D. Bunting, this normally stoic character said, being gay isn't a choice. It's a game, and I'm winning.
This normally stoic character. It's Holt, isn't it? But I don't know his first name. Except that it starts with R. I don't know. What's the answer?
The answer we're looking for was Raymond Holt. Raymond Holt.
Raymond! Not a name I would have guessed. 19.
All right, Eve Beatty, this is your S question. The full title of this 1995 Fox series followed Space with a colon, not an exclamation point. What's the full title?
The Final Frontier? No, wait. That makes no sense.
Incorrect. No. The show is Space Above and Beyond.
That one. Okay.
The ending of St. Elsewhere is famous for revealing the entire show may have taken place in a child's snow globe. What was the name of the snow globe's owner?
Tommy. Westfall?
Correct.
Tommy nice.
Wow.
Sarah D. Bunting. In the world of iZombie, if you absolutely, positively have to get your package there overnight, you call this River Pund Shipping Company.
This what shipping company?
River Pund. P-U-N-N.
River Pund.
E-D.
Shipping. Ripped from the headlines.
Yeah, I saw this last night or whenever I went
through. Yeah, not from the headlines. It was just on very, very, very recently.
I don't know. Utonium? I don't know the answer to this.
You gonna steal it?
Nah.
All right. The answer we're looking for was U freight, ease. Euphrates.
Oh, very cute.
All right, Eve Beatty, everybody's last question before the next score break. Of all the forgettable shows to follow Seinfeld's time slot during the must-see TV era, this was a Kirstie Alley-est.
Veronica's Closet.
Correct.
Yes.
Tara Ariano, W.
Yes.
Long before he handled Gus Fring's dirty work, Jonathan Banks handled FBI undercover agents as Frank McPike in this show.
Walker, Texas Ranger.
Incorrect.
I wish that had been right.
The show we were looking for, Wise Guy. Wise Guy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, as we hit the end of the alphabet, this answer could be X, could be Y, or could be Z.
Ooh, tricky.
If you said, I don't know, on this Canadian kids TV show, they would pour green slime on your head.
Oh, you can't do that on television.
That is correct, and that is the halfway mark of the game. Scores, please.
Okay, still super close. Eve has 4 points, Sarah has 6 points, I have 7 points.
All right, so this is round two. We're going to change the order just so you don't have the same letter all the time. So our order is now Tara, Sarah, Eve. So starting with Tara, A. If you paid for HBO in the late 90s, you could watch future Killing Eve star Sandra Oh as a sidekick to a sports agent.
Arliss.
Sarah D. Bunting. Susan Jacobs won the first ever Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Music Supervision in 2017 for this HBO series.
Music Supervision for this HBO Big Little Lies?
Yay!
Eve Beatty, this short-lived series about lawyers in the future, if it is remembered at all, is remembered for... Nano pants.
No idea.
Steel meal?
Steel.
Century City?
Century City. Space there lawyers.
Wow.
So, Sarah, you are now out of steel meals.
Tara Ariano, the letter is D. This early 2000s sci-fi series aired on Fox and was set in the year 2019. Unlike the year 2019, this lasted 2 years.
D. Ooh. Dark Skies.
Close. Dark Angel.
Oh, yeah. Right. The Albatross.
For Sarah, before Parks and Rec, Chris Pratt had his first major role on this show.
Oh, Everwood.
Correct. Eve. Carrie Coon and Allison Tolman are two super ladies who worked on this series.
Friends?
The answer, Fargo.
Wouldn't have minded seeing them on Friends, though.
Back to Tara.
Yes.
If you're lucky, they might open up a can of peaches for you at this frontier establishment.
The Gem.
The Gem. Sarah D. Bunting. Episode titles on this one-season UPN show include House Party or Play That Funky Music, White Droid, and There's No Space Like Home or Return of the Jedi.
This one-season Fox show?
UPN.
UPN.
UPN show.
H.
The Secret Diary of Desmond Pfeiffer.
The show we were looking for, Homeboys in Outer Space.
Oh, those bastards.
All right, Eve, your letter is I. This show was Josh Holloway's first big post-Lost project. He starred as tech-augmented federal agent Gabriel Vaughn.
Actually watched this and I can't remember.
We all watched one episode. Oh.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
It aired for three.
I don't know. Oh, really? I don't know, recall the name.
Maybe I just watched for three. But the show was Intelligence.
Fuck.
Yeah. All right, yeah. Tara. Listen to the following clip.
Hello,
This theme from the first two seasons of Lost in Space was composed by whom?
Jani Elfman.
You're on the right track. If you thought about it longer, you might have got it. John Williams.
Who's going to go with Jerry Mancini, but yeah.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting. She replaced Meghan Markle, who apparently had something better to do, on Suits. The good news is she probably won't have any Emmy nominations to complain about. Little editorializing by our question maker, but I'm here for it.
Kelly Osbourne. I don't know.
Katherine Heigl.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Good for her.
Eve Beatty. L. Identify the company from this advertisement.
And we know only the best will do for you and your family. What does family taste like? In your heart, you know it's the best ingredients. The spiciest spices. All prepared with love and care. And always delivered with a friendly smile. That's the promise.
Come in and try our new curly fries. We are so sure you'll like them. And if you don't, they're on me.
Taste the family.
All right. What's the company from that ad?
Larbies?
Anybody know it? Tara, do you recognize the voice at the end?
Of course. Yeah. I didn't get it until I heard his voice. Yeah, that's Los Pollos Hermanos.
Yes, correct. Your M question, Tara. Yes. This sushi master is the only person to be an Iron Chef in both the Japanese and American versions of the franchise. Now, because he has a M first name and M last name, I will accept just the last name, which he was usually known by on the show.
Oh. All that's coming to mind is Melvar, because we watched that episode recently. I don't remember his name.
Steel mill. Morimoto?
Yep. Correct.
Yay.
Nice.
Masaharu Morimoto.
Nice work.
Okay. All right. This is your N question, Sarah D. Bunting. Hens love roosters. Geese love ganders. Everyone else loves this man. Hens love roosters, geese love ganders, everyone else loves this man.
Name it.
The answer is hens love roosters, geese love ganders, everyone else loves Ned Flanders.
Oh.
All right, Eve, your O answer. Before HBO was known for prestige TV, the trashy pro football comedy First and Ten starred what former player?
O.J. Simpson?
I mean, who else would it be?
Really?
Yeah.
Tara?
Yeah.
The original run of ABC's TGIF debuted in 1989 with these four sitcoms: Full House, Family Matters, Just the Ten of Us, and What?
Oh, God. Step by step. I don't know.
The answer, Perfect Strangers. Perfect Strangers.
Of course.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting. He's best known for his films, but he's directed episodes of CSI and ER, acted on Alias, and voiced a Kung Fu Gibbon on Duck Dodgers.
Quentin Tarantino.
Correct. All right, Eve, after this, we'll do our score break, which I missed a couple moments ago. This EGOT winner actually won two Emmy Awards, one for The Rockford Files and one for The Muppet Show.
Rita Moreno?
Correct. All right, quickly, the scores, please, Tara.
You're not going to believe this, but it's still real close. Eve has 7 points. I have 9 points. Sarah has 10 points.
All right, we have two questions left for everybody. Let's get back to it. This is for Tara. This show, and to remind you, we are at S. This show is the last remaining vestige of the WB.
Supernatural.
Nice.
Name the post-Friends 90s sitcom that also starred Lauren Graham, Jenna Elfman, Molly Ringwald, and Ron Livingston.
Suddenly Susan.
The show Townies. Eve Beatty. Ellen Page was the odd woman out in A Clan of Superheroes in this 2019 Netflix drama.
The Umbrella Academy.
You are correct. Everybody's last question coming at you. Tara Ariano, V. When the star of this show had a contract dispute with the network, she was fired and the show was renamed The Hogan Family.
Valerie Harper. Oh, I'm sorry, Valerie's Family.
W. Salem was this network's first foray into original scripted programming.
WGN?
Correct.
Yay!
Eve Beatty. XYZ. This spaceship captain suffers from a very sexy learning disability called sexlexia.
Zorg?
Tara knows the answer to this one, I bet.
I do. It's Zap Brannigan.
Zap Brannigan from Futurama. Correct. All right. That is the end of regulation. Let's hear the scores, please, Tara Ariano.
Okay. Strong showing from everybody. Eve finished with 8 points. Sarah and I are tied with 11 points each.
Oh, shit. So that means we have to use our tiebreaker. If Tara gets it, she wins the season. If Sarah gets it, she gets to live another week. Here we go.
Cool.
I'm going to read you another description. The show in question, its first word is a number. Here we go. I'm going to let you answer it anytime, okay?
All right.
Hank Gallison, publisher of a paranormal skeptics magazine, gets caught up in a hunt for the holiest of relics going back to the early days of Nazi Germany after his wife Layla is abducted.
0 hour.
0 hour is correct. Mark Green fighting Nazis, writing magazines.
In the ice.
Oh my God.
I can't believe I remember that.
Good
I can't believe
job, that either. Sarah.
Nicely done.
Sarah.
And I get to live.
Yeah.
This is great.
All right, guys. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We pushed and shoved our way into the season 2 opener of Big Little Lies, and Tara incorporated it into a tiny triumph-worthy HBO Kit Kat jingle of note. We reported on the going-ons at the 2019 ATX Television Festival before going around the dial with stops at Pose, RuPaul's Drag Race, and Black Mirror. We assembled our custom TV A-teams in the event we have a problem and nobody else can help. We assembled our custom TV A-teams in the event we have a problem and no one else can help, while Francoise cooked up the right recipe for getting Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown Senegal episode into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's ABC TV Trivia Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Girls Divorce,
Sarah D. Bunting,
we're in the key of F, Madeline,
and Eve Beatty.
Alexa, turn off life support.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
What the hell was that? That was a very strong position, and I didn't like it.
This series presents information based in part on theory and conjecture. The producer's purpose is to suggest some possible explanations, but not necessarily the only ones to the mysteries we will examine.